It is now my privilege to introduce our main speaker, who comes to us from Cypress Wood Group in Spring, Texas, Danny B.
Danny, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Keith picked me up at the airport, and everything went pretty smooth. I drove to the airport at noon. I flew out of Hobby, which I live in Spring, and Hobby's like 60 miles south. I don't know why we didn't choose Houston Intercontinental, which was 15 minutes away, but that's not the alcoholic way of doing things. Just drove south and got on one and then headed up here. But it's been good. It's good to see friends. I've seen Caroline and Dorothy and Keith and Larry Johnson and many others. And this is one of the areas that it's a little harder for me to be glib, because I spend a lot of time here, and people know you. You know, you can speak somewhere else. You know, you can take. We don't lie, but, you don't have to bring up certain things. And here, it's like, wow, you can hardly avoid it. But AA's been really good to me. If I make it to February the 18th, I will have been sober 32 years. And I'm absolutely amazed. I remember sitting at a noon meeting at Dallas North, and Dorothy asked me, she said, "Isn't today your birthday?" And I said, "Yeah, but I don't really care. I'm not that excited about it." And she said, "Oh, I'm very worried about you then." Because I was 13 years sober, and, of course, had you followed me around, you wouldn't have been excited about it either. But 19 years later, I can say that, she was probably one of the first voices. It was a wake-up call, because there's no such thing as alcoholism. You know, it's alcoholism, and it will just sneak up and get you while you're sitting here. I mean, you can go to meetings and just go to meetings and go to meetings and wind up being just as sick as rain. You know, there's stuff that I have to do. And fortunately, I've been blessed with people coming into my life. God has put people in my life, and I've had just enough pain and just enough willingness that I've not only survived, but I've thrived. And I'm really grateful for that. I have taken the position that AA is like monkey see, monkey do. You just have to find a monkey that's got like a good bunch of bananas. And you want one that's doing good and feeling well, and you want to follow that monkey. Because there's that one that's over there chasing the women. Don't do that. Yeah. And I look at my disease like a dancing gorilla. It's in the cage. It's locked away. But the monkeys like to go by and look at it every once in a while. And there's no problem as long as it stays locked up. But you got to remember, you're only a monkey, and it's a gorilla, and it's a dancing gorilla. And if you let it out of the cage, it doesn't stop. You don't get to quit when you're done. You quit when it's done. So I've been fortunate that I haven't unlocked the cage. I've come to the right to the edge and played with the lock, but that was a bad idea. And since in the last 20 years of my sobriety, I've taken AA very seriously. And I don't know when and how I began to grow up, but I did. And I'm so thankful for it. My life is just absolutely stellar. I live in Spring, Texas, and I sponsor a whole bunch of guys. I think 300, and 10 of them call me. And you know how that is. You meet my sponsor, and then you hear later that you're their sponsor. And I said, and how? And you know, you wonder am I doing? You know, but I got this. I live in this really big, nice house with this really big pool that I didn't want, but it looks good. And I have these dogs, and I have a wonderful wife. Her name is Vicky, and everybody loves Vicky, and especially me. And I'm just blessed, you know. I go to prisons regularly. I like to go to prisons. I'll explain a little bit why as I talk, but I go to prisons because they're in there. They're not only people that are in there for because they're supposed to be, but a lot of us are in there, and we're in there because of our condition, of what's wrong with us. And they're holding our people hostage. And you just want to go in there and tell them that, you know, you don't have to live like this anymore. I've met men since I've been going to prison that aren't going to get out. I mean, they're not. But yet they're free. I mean, I've met men in there that I'll go to the prisons and talk to them about life and about living the spiritual life, because these guys they're all in. And I want to be like that. So anyway, I usually start my talk with a joke, but I was obviously about 20 minutes into the talk I was going to start, which is kind of a joke itself. But I like my joke. You know, I've told it so many times, and the tapers don't want to hear it anymore. But, you know, it's the same one. If you were at the Eagles, it was that joke. You remember that? Well, I'm not going to tell it. Anyway, I will. What happens is the lady walks into a pharmacist, and she walks in there, and she hands him a note, and says which says I'd like to buy some cyanide. And he said, what for? And she said, well, I want to kill my husband. He said, ma'am, you can't walk in here and say something like that. They'll put us both in jail. And she reached in her purse and pulled out a picture of his wife and her husband in bed together and handed it to him. And he looked at it, and he said, well, that's different. I didn't know you had a prescription. I know there's better jokes, but that's the only one I can actually remember, you know. I spent a lot of my time in Dallas AA. It was good AA. I think you can get really grounded. AA in some places is kind of looks more like BB. You know, I mean, what's happening is people go to certain treatment centers, not all treatment centers, but some treatment centers, they teach them stuff, you know, and they're so profound that they come back over and teach it to us, and we're so sick of hearing each other, we think, well, that was really good. So that becomes AA, and before long, all we do is show up and talk to each other about things they're saying at the treatment center, and we get sick because, you know, what I have is a disease that will kill me deader than a hammer, and that's not something that I can play with. I'll tell you a little bit about how I came into alcohol. I'll usually tell you about my first conscious meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was in Midland, Texas. And it was in sometime in the fall of 1979. By the way, my sobriety date is 2/18/81. This was in 79 when I discovered you. I like to call that. You know how when you'll see people that you hadn't seen in a while, and they say, "Now, how long have you been sober?" And he'll look at him and he'll say, "Well, you know." This time I've been sober for 6 weeks, but I've been around since 1942. I understand that, you know, because I want credentials. I feel so bad on the inside. I want you to think well of me, and my length of time I think qualifies me. But that I call that your been around date, you know. And so I've been around AA since 79, but I didn't get sober till 81. But in 1979, my wife and I had been out on it had been a good one. And we had got down to the point that we just really couldn't stand each other anymore. And she kicked me out of the car in front of the 710 Club in Midland, Texas. And I was too weak to resist, and I didn't want her to go because I thought, you know, she had a date with her boyfriend. And I thought I didn't want her to go because I knew that would ruin our marriage. And I... Uh, you know, she tore off, and I walked into this nondescript building. It's just a big gray building, and I didn't know what it was. I just going to use the telephone. They didn't have cell phones yet. And I was going to use the telephone and call a friend and go save my marriage. And I stuck my head in the door, and there was a bunch of people sitting around in there playing cards and smoking and drinking coffee, and they saw me, and they were very happy to see me. And they invited me in, and, you know, and I kept trying to use the phone, and they started talking to me about things like they'd say, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And after a few minutes, I thought, you know, I think you're right. I'm not sure where we're going with this, but, you know, I'd like to use the phone. And, they just continued to talk to me, and they were nice. They offered me orange juice and honey, and I had no idea why. And finally, they said, look, if you'll stay for the meeting, we'll give you a ride afterwards. And I thought, okay. So they had a meeting, and, you know, it was a call-up meeting. People would come up to the podium when they were, you know, want Larry or Caroline to come up here and share a few things. And they just had one after the other would come up, and I sat out there and listened, and I thought, wow, I don't believe I'd have told that, you know. But the worse it was, the better y'all acted, you know. And when it was over, everybody stood up and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And then that place just erupted into laughter, and everybody lighting up cigarettes. And back then, they were all smoking meetings. And everybody was just talking at the same time. And I'm standing, you know, over to the side near the kitchen, and that thing that happens to me when I'm around anybody that I think has got it going on, it started to happen, and I just began to feel agitated and out of place, and I need to get out of here, and I'm kind of edging towards the side door because this is not a place for me. And you've told me that was that restless, irritable, and discontent feeling that I would get that would happen when I was sober, and it didn't happen when I was drunk. It happened when I was sober, and when I was sober, I knew what would fix it. I'd take a drink. I never had all of those thought processes. I just know I'm agitated. I won't be around them. You irritate me, and I need something to drink. But as I was standing there having all these thoughts, it seemed to me that place parted like the Red Sea, and here came a little short, dour-looking guy. He had a flat top, and he had two young guys right behind him. He was walking right straight to me, and I looked at him, and I saw him coming, and I thought, oh, hell no, I ain't going anywhere with him. And he walked up to me, and he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to Baskin-Robbins for ice cream. Would you like to go? And I thought, Baskin-Robbins for ice cream. Be still, my beating heart. There is no way on God's green earth that I'm going to go off with a bunch of geriatrics to Baskin-Robbins while my wife is out with her boyfriend. That ain't happening. But what came out of my mouth was, you know, sure, I'd love to go. So I wound up over at Baskin-Robbins holding a melting Rocky Road ice cream. And just said, is my phone ringing? Holy cow, really? I don't know. That was awful. Well, that was for me. That just shows you, and now you see how embarrassed I am. You would be that way, and I'm so glad I was a good example, a bad example for you. Well, my name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, shoot. Anyway, you know, these guys would try to pitch me on AA, you know, and I just, my eyes are glazing over, and I'm thirsty. I don't want to be there. And, you know, this kid stood up. One of these kids got up in front of me, and he said, you know, listen. He said, it's not the caboose that kills you. It's a locomotive. And I thought, I should have brought pencil and paper. You know, I'm sure that's going to be very helpful, but, I'm very busy. You know, I got problems. You know, at that time I had hot checks out, and I was living in a stolen car. My wife was living with her boyfriend. I wore an eye patch. There wasn't anything wrong with my eye. I just thought I looked really mysterious and cool. You know? later learned to call it West Texas Bling. That was all I could afford, you know. And my old stolen car was an old, terrible, beat-up stolen car. The guy didn't even want it back. You know, it was just a horrible car. You had to pour STP in it for, you know, thicken it up so it didn't leak out so quick. And, you know, and I'm out on parole. I hadn't reported to my parole officer, and I don't know when, because I'm a people pleaser, and I don't have anything good to report. You know, I'm not going in, and you know, you got hot checks everywhere, so you're limited on the places that you can go. And, you know, I'm stressed out, and I don't want to know about the locomotive. You know what I mean? I don't want to know about AA. I just want my wife to help me, and I want some money. I need money. I have always, when I came to AA, that was the one thing. I heard Jimmy Williams talking about it, being under-financed. And I sat there the first time I ever heard Jimmy tell that story, and I thought, I don't know what's so funny about that. That's true, you know. I am under-financed. If I had just had enough money, these things wouldn't happen to me. Fortunately, I stayed in AA long enough to see people who had enough money, and what happened to them was actually worse than what happened to me, if that could be believed. But anyway, that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And over the next, year and a half, 2.5 years, I just became a running drunk. I'd make it from Dallas to, you know, here at they had the old Alpha Club. And I'd come up here and run around with this guy named Ocean for a little bit. And I'd leave here and I'd go to Austin. And I'd leave Austin and I'd go to Midland. And you wear things out. You don't want to stay too long, you know. You stay there long enough to get a 30-day chip and new sponsor. I had about 40 sponsors before I ever even got a dry date. And, you know, life was just tough in AA that way. I'll tell you how I kind of, briefly, how I came to be in that situation was, I'm the eldest son of a couple of them that got married way too early. My mother was, my mother met my dad when she was 13, married him when she was 14, and had me when she was 15. And they were together until his passing with 65 years of marriage. And yeah, you ain't kidding. Especially with me, you know. But he went off to the war, and she, you know, she was a product of the Depression, and she was a child. Her mother had died in a sanitarium of vitamin deficiency. I think it was called beriberi. But she had just, you know, she got tuberculosis and died there, left like 12 kids when she was 38 years old, and my mom was one of them. So my mom was a very fearful child. My dad's off in the world is at war, and when he came home, he was eat up with fear, and he just started drinking heavy. And, sometimes he was a lot of fun to be around, and sometimes he was a little scary. And my mom finally told her that, you know, you either, you know, turn that around or we're out of here. Well, he didn't want to lose his family, so he just took all of that and just turned it to work. He became a workaholic, and he kind of withdrew from everything. But up until that time, he and I had been really close. I mean, I was the apple of his eye, and I adored him. And he used to play with me while he'd drink those old long-neck beers out in the backyard and play with me and listen to that Hank Williams music. And I remember him throwing me in the air and catching me and holding me and patting my head to his bare chest. And just, you know, and I remember feeling absolutely safe. You know, on a very visceral level, you just know that your world is right. You're with your dad. Nothing's going to hurt you. When he started working hard, well, he just quit interacting with me or anybody else, and he just turned to work. And my mom's the whole thing was, don't do that. You could get hurt. Well, hell, I'd be standing around waiting to see what was going to hurt me next. You know, you just don't do anything. And I'm already a high-strung kid. And by the time I'm in middle school, I got two much younger brothers, but by the time I was in middle school, man, I was about to have a meltdown. Everything was scary to me. And I went to school one day, and they played a film called Duck and Cover. And I watched the thing. It's a film that you play the film to show kids what to do in case a nuclear bomb goes off in your neighborhood. You know, and it shows the bomb going off and the buildings collapsing, and the little kids are all dressed up nice. You get your biggest book, and you go out in the hallway, and you put it over your head. Well, I wasn't their best student, but I knew that was woefully inadequate. And we left school that day. All the other kids wanted to play sports and plan careers and get girlfriends, and now I'm just concerned about national security, you know. And you've got a real ego problem developing when you take responsibility for things that you have no power to control. And that's just, you know, that's your focus. And now, so that's mine. And I knew that Midland wasn't safe, so I began to run away from home, and they started capturing me and bringing me back. And finally, they said, there's something really wrong, and they sent me to Big Spring State Hospital. And I went over to Big Spring State Hospital, stayed for 90-day commitment. When I got out, you know, they gave me my little psychotropic drugs, and I went home, and my folks tried to re-enroll me in school, and I was always escaping. And one night, I borrowed my folks' car, and I got all dressed up in the appropriate attire because I'm going to go hang out with the cool kids. And I drove down, we lived in Odessa, and I drove down to where they all hung out called Roy's. Drove in there, man, and I had on this white shirt. And I had my Camels rolled up in my shirt sleeve. I don't even smoke yet, but, you know, that's what you do. And it's a white T-shirt, and they're all rolled up, and I'm in my mom's station wagon, you know. And when I pull in there, the worst thing happened. There was the coolest guy in school there, and his name's Batman. And he's got a lowered 58 Chevy, and he's drinking beer, and he's got all of his buddies around, and, you know, he's smoking cigarettes, and they see me in my mom's station wagon, and I'm thinking, I got to go. But they saw me, and I got out of the car, and my cigarettes unrolled and fell on the ground, because I had little skinny arms that couldn't keep them up. And I became sport for them, and I was just humiliated. And they gave me a drink. They dared me to drink, and I took a drink. And in the course of that night, that thing that happens to us happened to me on my first ever run out of the chute. And man, I mean, I felt great. I could do things I hadn't been able to do. I didn't care about how I felt. I didn't care what you thought. And that night, I got into a fight. I got my nose broke. I chased a girl. Fortunately, I didn't catch her. And I wrecked the car. I went to jail. And I puked on myself. And all of that my first night. You would consider that to be, you know, you got to find something else to do than that. That just doesn't, you know, when you describe that evening, that just doesn't sound like something that you want to gather everybody up and let's go do that again. But on the inside, what happened to me was so profound that was a small price to pay. And the next day when I was in my folks' house and I had that pounding headache and that spinning bed, I remember thinking, I'll never drink with those guys again because they got me in a lot of trouble. And my folks thought that I'd got out of the mental institution a little early, so they sent me back over there, and I immediately escaped because they don't have anything to drink there. And I escaped, and they brought me back, and they put me on a locked ward. And this is where they were giving shock treatments. And I'm sitting here all locked up, and they're feeding me Thorazine. And eventually they weaned me off of that. And I'm just sitting here watching people get shock treatments. And I meet my two first good friends, the guys that were getting shock treatments. And we became buddies. In between their treatments, we weed baskets and play checkers. We bonded, you know, become buddies. But they were getting so many treatments that they began to lose track of how close of friends we were. So on Visitor's Day, I stole a car of a lady that had come to visit her little kid in there. And I broke those two guys out, and we made the trip from Big Springs to Midland. We got over to Midland, and we picked up two more guys who should have been in that hospital. And now we're heading south. My plan is to go to Mexico. This is my first gang, and I'm their leader. And, you know, I'm very energized. I'm excited because it's like, you know, we're going somewhere. The police are after us. The hospital's after us. You know, I've got people on my side. You know, I got a plan. And my plans are always, I'm a big picture kind of a guy. I never was into details. You know, I'm the kind of guy that would like, I will paint bullseyes. Well, actually, I'll shoot arrows. And then I'll go paint bullseyes around them. you know, and then I'll step back and think, you know, I'm hell of a shot. And it wasn't until I got to AA that I found out that I had all that sequence backwards. But I'm headed south to, you know, I've got these guys with me, and it's an exciting time. I think it's the best I've ever felt in my life. And we would go in these little mom-and-pop stores, and we would steal supplies. We'd create a diversion because we didn't have any money. And if you're escaped mental patients, creating a diversion is no problem. It's pretty easy. And we'd get what we wanted. We'd siphon some gas, and we'd head down the road. But the further we got from that hospital, those guys' meds began to wear off. And it became clear they were in that hospital for a reason. And it became increasingly difficult for me to gather my gang up and get them back in the car. You know, it was like herding cats. You know, they were just all over the place. I got them in the car, and we got across the border into Del Rio, Mexico, and I sold that car to a taxi driver for a few hundred pesos. And we then went across to Boys Town, and we're sitting in the Cadillac bar having a drink, and that's when I realized I'm out of plan. You know, I've got nowhere else to go here. We're just here. And while I'm thinking about what our next move is, one of these guys, something happened, and I heard all this commotion. And what had happened is one of these guys had just killed a parrot that belonged to a lady that worked down there because he thought that it said something ugly to him. He had like a psychotic episode, you know, and really did start a fight, you know. And so here come the local police and the federales, and I grabbed these guys and said, "We got to get back to Texas." And we ran for the border, and they caught us on the Mexican side, and we went to jail in Mexico. That's what I said. Yeah, see, because I'm now in jail in Mexico with a bunch of escaped mental patients, and my problem is that, you know, I'm not bilingual. I don't even know how to tell these people I want my mother. You know, I just, you know, and guys, y'all all know we're like that. You know, you're big and tough. You got tattoos on. You know, work out in prison and everything. But if you're in trouble, you'll call mama. You know, but I didn't know how to get a hold of her, so we were stuck down there. And somehow, some way, she found us. And to this day, I really don't know. I've heard her talk about it, which because she's in Al-Anon now for 33 years. I've heard her talk about the story, but I listened to her one time, and I said, "Where'd you get that story?" And she said, "Well, that's what happened." And I said, "I've been telling that story for a long time. That's not the way it goes." And she said, "Honey, some of your fondest memories never happened." And, I do know that she got me back, and we rode all the way back to West Texas, that she did her attempt at aversion therapy, and that's where she would find Mexican music and turn it all the way up and then quote scripture to me and try to shame me. And it really worked. I still hate that music. But we had a family meeting and decided that my dad told my mom, he said, "You know, I think he needs to join the Navy." "Well, you know, I have a bulletin for you. I'm an escaped mental patient. You know, I just stole a car. I'm sure the Navy's interested." Well, they took me. The day I turned 17, I joined the Navy. Gave me a gun. And I became a CB, and we island hopped around the Pacific, and I was a two-fisted drinker. I grew big and strong, and I really did love being in the Navy. It's one of the things, when I look back over my life, that I'm truly proud that I had the opportunity to serve, although not so great sometimes. Some days I was really pretty good in the Navy. Some days I'd really do my job good, but, you know, I would get restless, irritable, and discontent working in the hot sun, and I would go to the, you know, to the enlisted man's club, and I would have a drink. And then that's where I discovered that tequila had a bad effect on me, because I would drink tequila, and I'd black out. And also, I would fight, and, you know, sometimes cry, and that was embarrassing. So I would vow only to drink beer. And I would drink beer till I would forget that tequila was that detrimental, and I'd be drinking that again. And I'd black out and go places, and I was always getting what they call a captain's mask, and, you know, brought in, and you lose your stripes, and you get them back, and you lose them, and it seems like it's just an endless misery. It's like always trying to figure out how you're going to get something to drink, get to your job, get your stuff done, not get in trouble. You're always underfinanced, and you feel like everybody's watching you. And my military career culminated in Guam when I went out drinking with a couple of British sailors, and at the end of the night, they took me to their ship because they said they had liquor rations, and they did back then. Anyway, I went on board, and we took a drink, and I passed out, and they went to sea. And so, you know, and then it was pretty easy to figure out who's not British. And anyway, they get me back, and I get, you know, they do some research, because they said this is getting to be a real problem. And that's when they found out about my background, and they offered me a general discharge under honorable conditions. And I got out of the Navy, and I made it to Skid Row. And, I made it to Skid Row in L.A., and I learned to lie, cheat, and steal, and sell blood. I just learned how to survive. I drank. I learned one of my favorite things to do was to drink whiskey and take amphetamines, because then you could just be up and talk to people. Make friends. And I liked it because it kept me, it kept me from blacking out, and I could walk a lot. But I left California after a stellar career on Skid Row, and went back to West Texas and tried to work for my dad, who had an electrical business in Midland, Texas. But I was too out of control. My drinking was too advanced, and I had a bad temper, and he fired me, and I started hanging out at a bar. And I met some guys over here at this bar. They were stealing out of the oil field. They would come out at night. They were dressed real nice, had money and guns, and they drank Crown Royal. This was back in the bring your own bottle, brown bottle phase of Texas's evolution. And I wanted to do something with my life. And these guys needed some help, so I interviewed for the job and got it. And pretty soon, I've got a gun, a car, and I'm drinking Crown Royal, and I think, well, I'm a gangster. That's, everybody's got to be something. And I was doing pretty good, and I was okay with it. I was not burdened with any conscience about this whatsoever. I was, it seemed to me to be the perfect thing. We only came out at night. And it worked for, a few months, and then about 6 months, the Texas Rangers caught us, and everybody went to prison except me. Because I've not been in any felonious trouble, they gave me a probation. And they told me all I had to do was stay away from those kind of people, meet the terms of my probation, don't drink, and hold down a job, and everything would be okay. And I really, really, really wanted that. I mean, I had seen the light sitting in jail, and I thought, I don't want to go down this path. This is not for me. And I got out, and I got a job, and I meant everything in me, and I didn't drink. And about 3 weeks into my not drinking, holding down a job, I was pumping gas right almost across the street from my favorite bar. And I looked in there at that guy that was driving that car waiting on me to finish up, and I thought, this guy's an idiot. He can pump his own gas. And I just left the nozzle running in his car, and I went into the cash register and got a cash advance, went across the street. And I took a drink. And when I came to, I was 300 miles away. I was in Dallas. And I wasn't long till I was in just as much trouble there as I was anywhere else, because as we learned here, wherever you go, you take you with you. I got here, and I had Sheriff Decker's boys chasing me all over the place, and he's pretty good at his job. And, of course, catching a drunk's really not that hard. And they got me, and I got 13 five-year sentences, and I was sent to TDC. Fortunately for me, it was run concurrently, and I did my time in prison, and I can tell you it's very time-consuming, doing time, and I wasn't one of those who got in there and drank a lot in there, and I wasn't, I really wasn't inclined to do drugs, so I didn't get into that, and I just stayed sober, and I believe that I came out of prison probably 3.5 years sicker than when I went in. Because I was more resentful, more agitated. I had done more time to think. A friend of mine, Peg Martin, likes to talk about being a binge thinker. That's what I am. I binge think. Once I get onto something, I pick it to pieces. And I got out of prison, and one of the things I had told myself is I'm never going to drink again except on special occasions. And getting out of prison is a very special occasion. And so I had a drink, and on the way home, I was sitting in the back seat drinking, and my mom was taking me home, and I was telling her all the wonderful things that I was going to do because I was feeling better by the mile. And she said, "Honey, what you need is a wife, a kid, a car, a bank account, a job, and a house. You'd be all right." And I said, so I went out and I found a woman that had kids, a bank account, a job, and a car. I married her, and my mother was wrong. That was the worst 2 weeks of my life. I left that woman, and I was hanging out downtown in Odessa, Texas, and I was just doing what I do. You know, I don't know how you can afford your life, but somehow you manage to be able to drink. You manage to be able to scuffle enough together to find a place to stay. You're always staying here, you're staying there, you're getting out of jail, always being picked up for PI, and you're just a nuisance, and you wonder how in the world, how do you get it to where you can wait all week long for a paycheck? I had to get paid every day, because I would do day labor, because they'd pay me today, I could get something to drink today, and I was exhausted, and I still was in my 20s. And I went into the bar one night, and I'm sitting there drinking, and a girl come in, and she was an attractive lady sitting over the corner. She was crying. I went over to check on her. And as we got to talking, it turns out that she was pregnant, and her folks wouldn't let her come home unwed. They weren't going to have it. He was a fairly important figure in Oklahoma politics, and he wasn't going to have that. And we hatched a plan that night that we would get married. We met that night, and we had a three-day waiting period. We married 3 days later. And I called my mom. I said, "Mom, I'm married." And she said, "I know." And I said, "Well, I don't know how you could have just did it." And she said, "Oh, my God, you have a wife." And I thought, details. I'm always getting tripped up with details, but. But I decided to go ahead and go on my honeymoon, so we got a fifth of whiskey, and we got on a Greyhound bus and made that trip from Midland, Odessa to McAlester, Oklahoma. And when we got off the bus drunk, my father-in-law was there to pick us up in a chauffeur-driven limousine, and he was obviously an influential man and pretty disgusted. We went to his house, and it was a big mansion, lots of bedrooms, and I went upstairs, passed out. Came to, went down on the veranda to have a cigarette, and I looked out across this big yard, and I saw his place of business. And I had married the warden of McAlester Prison's daughter. And what are the chances of this? I mean, I was very uncomfortable in that relationship, and I absconded. That means to move in a secret way. And I got back to West Texas, got back to my bar, and my life, this is the point where my life just takes a turn for the worse. And, it just continues on and on and on. And there's like no end to the misery. I go back to prison. I marry again. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been in mental institutions twice. I've been in prison for extended periods. I've lived on Skid Row. I'd never been able to get untracked about anything. The best shot I'd ever made in my life was the second time I got out of prison. And it didn't take me any time near a bottle to be right back where I was. And all of the things I was going to do right, I now couldn't do right. And now I'm drinking and coming up with one good plan after the other, which landed me in a stolen car wearing an eye patch, just waiting to go back to prison. And that's the way I was when I met you in Alcoholics Anonymous. And God, thank God I did. There was a talk I heard that gave me chills called Seconds and Inches. But for Seconds and Inches, none of us would be here. Because I think about this. There was only one club in Midland, Texas. There weren't multiple clubs. She didn't know that was AA. I didn't know anything about AA. she just got sick of me right there. And I got kicked out of the car in front of the only place I could go that would do anything for me. And I walked in looking for an opportunity to use the phone and maybe hustle somebody for enough money for a drink. And what I got was a cup of coffee and a brand new life. And it's been the most spectacular thing. In February of 81, February the 18th of 81, February the 17th of 81, I came to in that old car down in Austin, Texas, and I said a prayer. And I said, God, I'd do anything if I could just get sober. And two men came from the Northam group to get me. And one of them was John Henry McDonald. And he became my sponsor. And he was just this firebrand. And he was lit up with AA. He had a young guy with him, and I'm riding back in the back seat. And I'm headed back to the club, and I said, John, what am I going to do? And he said, oh, Danny, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And I said, well, how do you do that? He said, well, don't drink right now. And then when it's right now again, don't drink then either. And that kid that was with him was a smart aleck. He said, yeah, pretty soon you'll have a minute. John Henry said, don't pay any attention to him. He said, let me tell you something. He said, those minutes will become hours. The hours will become days, weeks, months, years. You do what we do. Follow us in this thing. Join us in this thing we do, and you'll have a brand new life. You'll be able to go places, do things, and have a good life. And right there, drunk in his car, I was smitten with a magnificent obsession for sobriety. I wanted to be with you and like you more than anything else in the world. I mean, I absolutely thought that you were the most brilliant people, the most caring and loving people. And it turns out, corporately, I wasn't wrong. Individually, I might have made a mistake. But as a group, this is the place. I'm going to tell you, if you are, I know there wasn't anybody under 30 days, but if you're new here, you look around this room and you look to your right and left and you see people who have destroyed their lives with booze. They've destroyed their marriages. They ruined their relationships with their kids. They've been to prison and mental institutions. They've ruined their businesses. And they'd like to guide you into your new life. And the fact is that they're capable of doing that because they found an answer here. They found an answer to the problem. They found a solution, and it's power. It was not taking a drink and access to a power that changes everything in an instant. I took the steps, and when I did my fifth step, at the end of my fifth step, my sponsor asked me to go and think about what I had said about Town Lake. When I got to Town Lake and my foot hit the ground, I'm telling you, the moment that I stepped out of that old stolen car, I felt this power wash over me and through me, and I knew for sure that this was God himself, and I was never going to have to drink again, and that I could live a good life. I just wouldn't have to live the way I did anymore. And it was a wonderful, wonderful feeling. And I'm still living underground. You know, I haven't reported to my parole officer. I am in a stolen car. But I'm on fire for AA. I'm 12-step king, man. If you want to, you need somebody that will go to the barrios or go to the, you know, anywhere, I would go. And I loved it. But about 6 months sober, my world began to cave in. And I began to feel all of that stuff back again. And I'm just falling apart. And I finally called John Henry. And I said, John, I'm not going to make it, man. And he said, meet me at the club. And I'm going to close with this really quick. I'm going to tell you what happened. Is I went to the club and I met with John Henry. And he said, Danny, he said, I'm going to tell you something. He said, what's standing between you and that God that you met on Town Lake are the things that are on your eight-step list. He said, there are people that seem to be able to come to AA and just kind of limp along and their lives are better. And he said, I don't have any problem with that. He said, but there are those of us who are nothing short of a psychic change that is induced by the full work that's done in the steps is necessary. And he said, I think you're one of those. And I said, well, John, there's some things I didn't tell you. And he said, what is it? I said, well, I live in a stolen car. And he said, well, that's a problem. And I told him about the parole officer, and then I told him what was the big secret. I said there was a bank robbery in San Angelo in the summer of 1980, and they've got it on videotape, and they're looking for me. And he said, well, son, you've got to go in tomorrow and clean that up. And I said, oh, no, I can't do that. I said, they will lock me up the rest of my life. He said, you told me when we started this that you were willing to go to any length to have this gift. I said, that's theory. This is very serious. And he said, well, get you another sponsor because you won't make it with that. You can't stay sober holding that. I sat in the car that night in front of that club, and I was just in despair. And I finally just said to God, my understanding, I said, I don't have the courage to do it. I wish I did. If you want me to do it, you're going to have to help. And I had a flash of understanding and a peace fall on me, and I knew something I'd never connected. The four walls do not make a prison. Prison is something you carry around on the inside of you. And I really did, as it says in our book, I had the keys to the kingdom. I had the choice now of either running and doing what I've always done, or I could face my life. I could face my problems square on with God's help. And I did. The next day, I went down there. I walked into the robbery department in Austin, Texas, and I told them who I was, and they wanted to know where I'd been. I gave them they gave them all my good AA stuff. And then they called in an FBI agent, and they brought in a tape and put it in a VCR, and I watched it with them. And it was a tall, skinny guy with a beard and glasses going from till to till. And he had a gun, and I was like, man, I just sunk. I thought, I wonder what I did with the money. Because I'm a blackout drinker, and I was in the area. And that is my M.O. After the second time he played it, a little old grainy video, he turned around and looked at me and he said, you know, the guy I'm looking for wouldn't walk in here. He said, the guy I'm looking for is out there. And he said, we'll find him. He said, but you need to get your skinny butt back to AA. And maybe you can do something about the mess you've created. And I thought, I'm in AA forever. All those things obviously have just been cleared up. There was one thing after the other in the ninth step process of dealing with all that stuff. But with your encouragement and God's help, His power, one thing after the other clears up. And I've had my ups and downs in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've made terrible mistakes and I've made some good decisions, but I've had a wonderful life. I will tell you that. And I'm going to sit down with this. I'm going to tell you that my dad, who died just 2.5 years ago and who I still miss, we had the hardest time reconnecting because he just, you know, he was the salt of the earth. He was one of those, your words, your bond, and one of the greatest generation. And he didn't know what to think about me or to do with me. He just didn't know what to do. So when I tried to make amends to him at 7 months sober, he said, that's fine, son. He just wanted to sweep it under the rug. Well, so did I. But I wanted that relationship. And I would ask you over and over. Jim Puckett would tell me, you just continue to be a good son. You continue to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You trust God. You always do what you're supposed to do to the best of your ability. And when you don't, we have a step that covers that. And I got myself, at the time I was 13, 14, or I don't even know when, but it was years ago, I got myself into a real mess here in Dallas, playing the big shot. And I had to go back to Midland and make amends to a former partner. And when I went back there, I had gone through the steps, and I was back making amends, and I was cleaning things up, and I spent the night at my mom and dad's house. And I went to an AA meeting, and when I came home, I walked in, and I saw my mom. And she said, and I, when I walked in the door, I said, I saw my dad, and I said, is he asleep? And she said, he's just pretending to be. And I walked back in there where he was, and he was laying there, and time had worn him down. Instead of this big, strong, handsome guy, he was in his 80s, and he was bald, and he just was laying there bare-chested, and I looked down at him, and I just leaned down on impulse and kissed him on his old bald head. And before I could pull away, he grabbed my head and pulled it to his chest, and he held my head. And he patted my head, and he said, I didn't know what to do, boy. And I said, "Me neither, Pop." He said, "Those people in AA," he said, "I hope you'll always remember to tell them how much we appreciate what you've done for our family. Because you've not only given me sobriety, but, I mean, you understand that dysfunction isn't that dysfunctional. That doesn't mean broken. Dysfunctional means that it's put together wrong. It works, but it's painful. It moves along with a limp." And when I got that opportunity to do that with my dad, it's just like one cog was put into place in that mechanism. And we began as a family to move along a little smoother. And our lives got better. And I began to understand what you had been trying to tell me all along, that if I would trust God and clean house, that these wonderful things would happen for me and countless others. And they have. And I love you and thank you.